This is the Senate Judiciary Committee on June 22, 1989, 1:30 p.m., Hearing Room 343. We have a work session on Senate Bill 895 and House Bill 3303. We have public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3400, House Bill 3493, and House Bill 5038.
Senator Grinsky.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I want to say that you've been working hard on this. I want to thank both you and Catherine. Catherine has worked through this bill diligently over weeks and months.
I wanted to point that out. I appreciated her doing this in the final hours here. But we do have, you'll see in front of you, I think, A3 amendments to Senate Bill 895. And perhaps Catherine would explain them to the committee before we take further action.
Okay. Catherine. Okay. This amendment changes the damages provision. It takes away the mandatory treble damages and instead allows punitive damages when appropriate. It also makes a change regarding third-party liability, and that is it allows the claim owner to collect for damages which might be sustained by the original owner or the owner of the land itself.
Okay.
It basically alleviates the concern I had that an owner of a mining claim would be recovering for damages to property that he or she had no right to recover for. And Catherine did a real good job of getting that put together. And then we dumped the treble damages, which, as I understand it, the sponsors of the bill don't have any real concern with. So unless anyone has any questions, I'd go ahead and like to move the A3 amendments to Senate Bill 895.
Okay. Senator Grinsky has moved the A-3 amendments to Senate Bill 895. Are there objections to Senator Grinsky's motion? Hearing none. So ordered.
Madam Chair, with that, I'd like to move Senate Bill 895 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Grinsky has moved Senate Bill 895 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Call the roll, please.
Aye.
Brockman?
Aye.
Grinsky?
Aye.
Hill?
Aye.
Aye. All right, motion carried. Thank you very much. Okay, let's. General Cromer is here. Let me wait just a minute till we get a couple more members, and we will still make sure that you get out of here by 3 o'clock. Let's then take up House Bill 3400. Catherine's been working on this bill. Jackie and Paul Elsner. Eric Carlson and Paul Snyder, why don't you all come up? You're there. Paul? And Catherine, we do have Weber amendments. Catherine might want to make comment first, I guess, about your amendments.
Right, Senator. The amendments delete what effectively is Section 3. And the concern there is that it grants very, very broad authority, in fact, maybe unconstitutional on two bases. One, failure to give due process notice, and two, there's a potential privileges and immunities issue that may arise under that. I've talked with Kathleen Buffet about it, and so the amendment before you is to delete that section.
Okay, great. Jackie and Paul, who you want to go respond or tell us about the bill as you see it, too.
I'm Jackie Bloom from the City of Portland. With me is Paul Elsner from our City Attorney's Office. We have discussed the proposed amendment to delete that section of the bill, and we find that we can agree that the bill will still have its main purpose accomplished in doing so. I'll turn this over to Paul for a couple of brief remarks about what we're trying to do in the bill.
Great. Thanks, Paul.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Elser. I'm a deputy city attorney for the city of Portland, and I'm here today to testify in favor of House Bill 3400, which is presently being considered by this committee. The genesis of the original bill can be found in two recent Court of Appeals decisions, Linn County versus 26.16 acres and City of Springfield versus $10,000 in U.S. currency, both of those cases being forfeiture actions. Those two decisions specifically held that the terms of ORS 30.315 sub 3 prevented cities and counties from employing the remedy of civil forfeiture via a local enactment to deal with conduct that is treated as a crime under state statute. If those rulings could somehow be limited to forfeiture, they would not be so troublesome for local jurisdictions, because the issue of forfeiture is presently being addressed in other legislation pending before this body, which is HB 2282. Unfortunately, however, relative to other areas of civil enforcement of municipal or county regulations, those opinions would continue to have viability in that they prevent the employment of civil remedies, including injunctive relief, to address a wide range of municipal code enforcement problems when there may also be a state criminal statute on the subject. For example, under the terms of ORS 479.990 sub 5, it is a crime to violate the state's electrical safety law. Many jurisdictions, including Portland, enforce the electrical safety law, which they have adopted by reference and placed into their own municipal or county codes. Enforcement is often done civilly, making sure that the buildings and personnel that are covered by the terms of that electrical safety law comply with its terms. However, under the terms of the two cases, civil enforcement as provided in municipal codes would not be able to be done, as there is a state criminal statute on the subject. Thus, we have the anomalous situation of a building which is out of compliance with the electrical code, but the only remedy is a criminal one, and the electrician would have to be thrown in jail. Another example of this situation would be in the area of nuisance control. The City of Portland, like many other municipalities, has provisions in its municipal code to deal with littering and nuisance control. However, there are state statutes found at ORS 164-785 and ORS 164-805 that deal with this conduct as well. Under the Linn County and Springfield decisions, the city's civil regulations requiring that litter be picked up or that the owner of property actually keep their property clean could not be judicially enforced under the terms of the Linn County and Springfield decisions because there is a state criminal statute on the subject. These two examples show that there are, in fact, cases which are sometimes treated under as criminally under state statute where the employment of civil restrictions is much more appropriate. After all, it is better to compel a person to clean up garbage than to jail him for not doing so. To essentially forbid the city from employing civil remedies to deal with these types of problems seems to be a misuse of the criminal sanction, especially in light of the limited resources we know are available to deal with even serious criminal behavior. To now, by way of these decisions, to have put further strain on that same limited resource, in other words, to add the enforcement of state criminal statutes dealing with littering or licensing of electricians or plumbers or builders or effluent control to the more serious felony matters would, the city believes, overwhelm the criminal system. That is not to make light of the problem of nuisance control or littering or abandoned vehicles. The problems caused by that type of behavior are serious and degrading to the citizens who must deal with it. It is just to say that to make someone a criminal and then not permit the city to deal with cleaning up the problem seems absurd. The bill would allow cities and counties to utilize civil remedies in the five circumstances already listed in ORS 30.315 and use those in addition to criminal remedies that may also be provided either in the county's or city's own municipal code or by state statute. It would also allow cities and counties to seek civil sanctions, such as civil penalties, should cities and counties deem that conduct prescribed warranted that type of sanction. Finally, the bill does away with a limitation on the use of this civil sanction where a state criminal statute is extant on the same subject, in essence, allowing for a parallel civil prosecution to occur. I'd be happy to answer any questions that...
Senator Brockman.
I should have probably asked this before he started, but could you explain to me how the city of Springfield can sue $10,000 in U.S. currency?
Certainly. It's what's known as an in rem action. An in rem action.
Okay.
You are suing, in fact, the thing and not a person, Senator Brockman. It is the same way those are found oftentimes in forfeiture actions. You're not suing a person. You are suing the item that you are seeking to forfeit. That is why.
Okay.
The thing is actually is a thing that is offensive to the statute or to the state.
Catherine?
Yeah, I just want to verify my understanding. My understanding is that Section 1 adds in rem or property, and that is the only substantive change. That the other change in deletion of a language, turnaround, unclear language that's already in the statute, and specifically around the issue of a penal fine?
Correct.
So that the only substantive change would be to add in rem authority to the in rem jurisdiction to Section 1.
Correct.
No other substantive changes are intended by that.
No other substantive changes are intended or were written in. That the in rem section addition is found at line 7 on page 1, and the deletion which was referenced is found at lines 15 and 16 on page 1. But though that only the first one relative to the in rem action is actually a substantive addition. The other is just a deletion of a archaic language, and it was not intended, although it could be arguably seen as that. But that's there are no substantive provisions or additions other than that. Right.
Okay, thank you.
Are there any other questions? Senator Springer?
Paul, I don't know if you had written comments. I'm just kind of looking at this case here. Where is the dividing line between civil wrong and a criminal wrong as far as the city is concerned?
Senator Cohen, Senator Springer, I don't think it's up to the city, it's up to the courts to decide that, and they've decided that under Brown versus Multnomah County. So I think it's going to have to be done on a case-by-case basis. I can't give you that. It's where there's punitive intent is what the courts have been using. The Supreme Court has used that in terms of Mendoza versus Kennedy, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case out of the 70s. And the Oregon Supreme Court, in an opinion written by Justice Lindy in Brown versus Multnomah County District Court, dealt with that issue and set out 5 indicia. But I couldn't answer that specific question for you other than on a case-by-case basis.
Further questions?
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you. Paul Snyder.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and we support passage of Senate Bill or House Bill 3400 for the reasons already given by the City of Portland.
Eric Carlson.
For the record, Eric Carlson, League of Oregon Cities. We support the bill.
Thank you. Thanks very much. David Benanke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm David Fidanke, Associate Director of the ACLU of Oregon. It's not clear to me that this doesn't make any other substantive changes in terms of the language which is deleted. The current subsection 2 prohibits imposing a penal fine in a civil proceeding. I don't see any reason to delete that from the current statute. Arguably, that is prohibited by the Constitution, and certainly would be prohibited under Brown versus Multnomah County District Court. I don't see any harm in leaving it in the statute.
Okay, well, this is a relatively finely crafted amendments here, so.
I understand that. I guess our primary concern all along with the statute has been the authority to enforce forfeitures. We certainly support committee staff's amendment. The only alternative I'd like to just throw out for the record would be to leave the existing subsections 2 and 3, and in subsection 3 say the remedies provided by section 1B shall not be used to enforce any requirement or prohibition, etc. So that it was clear that that provision only applied to forfeitures. It seems to me that that's the only one in this list that has the likely consequence of having a penal effect, and would be an alternative way to deal with this.
Catherine, do you want to comment or respond? We don't have to.
I'd rather not.
Okay.
Other questions?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry to do this. Maybe Council can respond, but I see we've got a Section 4, the in-gross bill. We've got 2282 is kind of cross-referenced in here. What's that all about?
If you look down on lines 17 through 19, basically it says nothing in this section, meaning what would be left up here, Section 1, shall affect the limitations imposed on cities and counties by 2282. So if 2282 becomes law, it supersedes what's in this bill.
What's 2282?
I believe that's the major forfeiture bill.
Yeah. And 2282 requires that it gives cities and counties the authority to enact forfeitures that are not covered in 2282 as long as they follow the procedures for forfeitures that are set out in 2282.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Any other comments? I guess the chair would move the Weber amendments dated 6/22/89. Are there objections to those? Hearing none, so ordered. Okay.
Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 3400 as amended to the floor to pass recommendation.
Senator Hill has moved House Bill 3400 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Call the roll, please.
Aye.
Brockman?
Aye.
Rinsky?
Aye.
Hill?
Aye.
Shoemaker?
No.
Cohen?
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. Okay, let's move to House Bill 5038. We have the Attorney General here, and we're here to talk about, this is the budget of the Department of Justice. It was referred from the floor for us to take a look at the information gathering, whatever what's called, part that the budget note that was included in that budget. Mr. Romar is here to tell us a little bit about where the authority lies, what kind of authority, what the limitations in the authority are, David?
Madam Chair, thank you very much for the record. I'm Dave Frohnmayer, Attorney General. Believe it or not, I appreciate being in this forum to explain an issue of budgetary and of policy significance to the state. It is very important, based upon the concerns that I heard expressed in the floor debate yesterday, to make sure that this committee, at least, is clearly and fully understanding of what really is involved in this, as opposed to some serious misconceptions which apparently fueled concern yesterday. This should not be a surprise or a secret to anyone who has followed affairs in the state of Oregon, let alone followed existing programs. And that's the first point I'd like to make, Madam Chair. There is nothing new about criminal intelligence analysis. There is authority for this directly and completely. That authority was passed by the Legislative Assembly in 1977 in Senate Bill 1092. There was only one dissenting vote in the House and one dissenting vote in the Senate. It was passed at the request of then Attorney General Jim Redden and has been in effect ever since. The criminal intelligence analysis and assessment function is a statutory duty. It's not optional. It is a duty of the Department of Justice. That statutory citation is found in the handout letter that we prepared for Senator Mayee, who was the chair of our subcommittee, and he's being distributed to members of the committee. If you read subsection 2 of ORS 180.610, the authority to, the mandatory duty, to gather intelligence information statewide with respect to organized crime is clear. Before my tenure as Attorney General, the Organized Crime Section of the Criminal Justice Division of our department was carrying out this function. So the budget note, which was the subject of yesterday's somewhat acrimonious debate, in fact merely is an enhancement, a long-standing requested enhancement of an existing program which is of long standing. In implementation of this...
And I want to interrupt by saying that Jack has passed out to us an actual copy of the statutes, and you'll find the first one is the Attorney General Statutes 180-1010, and then you'll find on the third page the Investigation of Organized Crime 180-600, and the Attorney General is talking to 610. So that you can look at the entire statute if you care to, but that's what's there. Excuse me for interrupting.
No, that's fine, Madam Chair. That's perfectly appropriate because I'm on the issue right now. This is existing authority.
Right.
It is a long-standing program. It predates my tenure in the Department of Justice. It is absolutely vital to the state. In implementation of that mandate, for years we have had a statewide intelligence network which meets monthly on a regional basis in order to coordinate the dissemination and collection of law enforcement information among agencies, including federal agencies, as well as local law enforcement agencies. 2 years ago, however, we were approached by a number of local law enforcement officers, including Sheriff Dave Burks and Chief Brian Riley, both of whom are in this audience today, telling us of the tremendous need at the local level for an enhanced capability for intelligence analysis. Now, let me reemphasize that term. The Department of Justice in this particular function is not engaged as a frontline gumshoe. We are not in the street cop mode. This is an analysis function of existing information that comes to the attention of law enforcement authorities. And the basic question is, do we want law enforcement to be dumb or do we want it to be smart? Do we want to use the information that is existing and being collected to the best of our ability? Or do we want to have an ad hoc, uncoordinated system in which people who operate on region-wide, indeed sometimes worldwide bases in drug smuggling, simply would have the best of us because we don't have information?
Madam Chair?
Senator Springer.
Sorry to interrupt, but back to my days as a DA when I first met Chuck, and I remember the distinction we made between the district attorney's job, which was to prosecute, and law enforcement's job was to investigate. And I thought the line was pretty clear in terms of what our responsibilities were. I don't think anyone disputes the need for the function that you described. I think the question that arose on the floor was, is this not a law enforcement function which lies properly with the state police?
I think not, Senator Springer. It is a function which needs to be done on a statewide basis. The Department of Justice, since before my tenure, has had investigators who are peace officers and police officers.
Why are the state police inappropriate or incapable of performing this investigative function?
This is not an investigative function, it is an analytical function, and there is an important distinction, and I've just described it between the two, and I think you have recognized it, Senator Springer. That is, investigation is operations. Investigation is frontline law enforcement. The analytical capability that we are talking about is a supportive service. And in general, the Department of Justice and the state police distinguish their operations even as we work together between support services and frontline operations. It is also very important, and this is an issue that I'll come to when I talk about the safeguards in this procedure. It's also very important to have continuous legal oversight over the collection, security, and dissemination of information. That function simply cannot take place in the state police the way that it's structured. The state police are supportive of this unit. That's as recently as today that that office has reaffirmed its support. They have jointly helped us to develop the unit to where it is today. We intend to work with them. But it is recognized by local law enforcement as well as the state police that this is a function for the Department of Justice because of the need for legal oversight.
Okay, when you say this unit, how many, I know we're getting into budgetary matters, but it's important for us to know kind of a bit what's involved in the unit, how many people, what kind of personnel do you have in the unit?
All right, and
you know, I know you probably get to it, I'm just sort of...
And let me address it this way, Madam Chair. The function has been carried out for a long time among many people in the office. In the Criminal Justice Division. We have made it a unit simply to make sure that the specialization remains specialized. So the unit itself is simply carrying on a function that we have been doing. And I'll ask Chuck Pritchard, the Assistant Attorney General, who's the head of the Criminal Justice Division, to give you that detail for me.
Madam Chair, Chuck Pritchett. I'm with the Criminal Justice Division of the Department of Justice, members of the committee. The package consists of 15 individuals, the 7 intelligence analysts, 3 criminal intelligence coordinators, 3 support staff, and 2 attorneys.
That was the original package.
That's the entire package. Yes.
And then you're going to, the proposal is to add what to that, to expand it?
Oh, I'm sorry, the existing unit. Oh, the existing unit.
Right.
Basically, right now, we have 1 person assigned to this unit.
So you're going to go from 1 person to set to 17, essentially,
well,
to add on, or compile them, or pay them for a different job, or put them all together, or do something?
As part of it, Madam Chair, as part of it, the subcontract on the drug grant, we have hired an analyst and a coordinator and a support person already. So that's in addition to the function that Mr. Pritchard described. As you may know, we have the intelligence coordination subcontract of the federal drug grant that has come to the state of Oregon to do this on a statewide basis.
Okay, you've hired an analyst and what did you say? I'm sorry.
An analyst and coordinator.
Analyst, coordinator, administrative assistant.
I guess I'd be interested in what you have 1 person now, 1 person plus 3 really that you've hired. So you have essentially 4, and we're now planning to hire 3 attorneys, a number of investigators, some more analysts. What do you see them do? I mean, I'm interested in your defining the specific types of activities that those folks would be involved in.
Madam Chair, this is the most glaring gap in the statewide coverage that we have in the law enforcement system, at least as identified by local law enforcement. And I really do urge, if you have time this afternoon, to hear from Sheriff Burks and from Chief Riley and from Al Dean, the lieutenant with the Portland Police Bureau, who does their intelligence function. As you may see from the handout, and again, this is something on which you may wish to reflect, the study called Toward a Drug-Free America, developed by the National District Attorneys Association and the National Association of Attorneys General, has some specific recommendations with which these closely track about the need for coordinated analysis of data on a statewide basis. Again, that's for your reflective reading rather than exhaustive description this afternoon, but that describes a national movement in this direction, as we've recognized that local law enforcement, just on its own resources, is not adequate to deal with the investigation of drug smuggling and drug trafficking organizations that are regional or nationwide or international in scope. We hope, obviously, to have this closely coordinated with our responsibilities in coordinating the 7 regions that are currently receiving federal assistance under the drug grant. There's a crying need for that. A meeting has been scheduled in my office in the next several weeks of the intelligence coordinators of each of those regions. And that's obviously going to be the major startup of our thrust with respect to the drug monies. Have I responded to the chair's question?
I think so. I'd ask the kind of limitations, because the broad RICO Act does include investigate allegations of corruption, malfeasance. It's pretty broad. I mean, you can get involved in a whole broad range of things should all of a sudden you decide that the drug issues are taken care of by somebody else, or they suddenly go away, or whatever else you're doing here. So I guess we need, for the record, some real clarification of the limitations on exactly what you're going to do. Not just some, we're going to follow the federal pattern of the war on drugs, but what is that specifically going to entail, and what are the limitations that you have in terms of the kind of information that is collected and on whom? I guess that I'd refer to the original limitations of a law enforcement agency that you really are not a law, your criminal justice agency, but not a law enforcement agency, and the law enforcement agency folks do have some limitations on what they
yeah.
are
allowed
to do.
I'm pleased to address that issue, because I think the issue generally implicates the question of safeguards. That is, what safeguards are there over the use of this information? Is it properly accumulated? Have we taken precautions to make sure that it's utilized appropriately? Have we taken precautions to make sure that no one has slipped into this net because of political, religious, or other reasons? And the answer is probably at least fourfold, if I may. First of all, there is a legal component to this program. And that's why my response to Senator Springer's question was so adamant. And that is that it is very important to have legal supervision over the career professionals who are engaged in the accumulation, filing, use, dissemination, and purging of this data. That's number one. So we do have that component directly involved. Law enforcement knows, and that's a terribly important thing to remember, that it needs reliable information. We have no interest in unreliable information. It doesn't assist in crime fighting to collect it and to maintain it. Law enforcement's also acutely aware that the misuse of information can lead to all kinds of powers being stripped from them, because ultimately their credibility is their strongest suit with the public and with the legislature and with local city councils. We have had extensive experience in an organization called the Western States Information Network. That is a five-state information intelligence network composed of law enforcement agencies throughout the state. My office acts as the coordinator for the state of Oregon, the superintendent of state police, and